From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new documentary, The Control Room, takes us behind the scenes at the Arabic news network Al Jazeera just before and during the war in Iraq. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Jehan Nujaim, the director of the film, and Samira Kadir, a senior producer at Al Jazeera, who was prominently featured in the film. Also, we talk about how our language reflects today's political climate with our linguist Jeff Nunberg. He has a new collection of his commentaries called Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the 25th anniversary collection DVD of Sondheim's Sweeney Todd. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. military is denying that its strike on a house in the desert near the Syrian border in Iraq hit a wedding party. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett today says the U.S. military found no evidence that any children were killed in the attack. NPR's Eric Westervelt in Baghdad is following developments.
U.S. military officials continue to say that this was a suspected safe house for foreign fighters that they believe were coming in through Syria. They say they recovered some weapons, passports, money, and satellite communications gear in the area, and said it was a legitimate military target, not a wedding party. They say they called in close air support after receiving hostile fire from this suspected safe house. But local Iraqi medical officials near where the attack occurred tell NPR that at least 26 women and children are among the dead, and they insist that it was a wedding celebration.
NPR's Eric Westervelt in Baghdad. A member of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council says his Baghdad home and offices have been raided in an effort to discredit him politically. U.S. troops and Iraqi police conducted the raid in a search for officials from Ahmed Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress who were accused of fraud, kidnapping, and other charges. U.S. officials say Chalabi is not a suspect, but Chalabi says he's being harassed for his efforts to expose corruption in the U.N.'s Oil for Food program.
I have opened up the investigation of the Oil for Food program, which casts doubt about the integrity of the UN here. They don't like this.
Chalabi once enjoyed strong support from top Pentagon officials. President Bush paid a rare visit to Capitol Hill today, where he told Republicans in a closed-door speech that he's committed to the U.S. effort in Iraq. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president's meeting with Republicans from the House and Senate was a chance for him to rally members of his own party around his Iraq policies at a time when public support is dropping and when even some Republicans are openly questioning the administration's handling of the situation. This was not a question-and-answer session. The president spoke for roughly a half an hour. One GOP leader in attendance said Mr. Bush likened bringing democracy to Iraq to a child learning to ride a bike. The president said it's time for the Iraqi people to take the training wheels off. He was referring to his pledge to turn over authority to a still unnamed interim government by the end of June. The president said that date is firm, though the U.S. military will remain in place. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was virtually unchanged at 99.37 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 1 point to close at 18.96. This is NPR News. The founder of Wisconsin-based Strong Capital Management will pay a $60 million fine to settle allegations of improper trading in mutual funds. Richard Strong is also barred from working in the securities industry for the rest of his life. Anna Panoka reports from member station WUWM in Milwaukee.
Richard Strong personally apologized to investors. In a statement on the settlement, he admitted to frequent trading of Strong funds, something investors were told not to do. A civil complaint estimates Richard Strong personally gained $1.8 million from improper trading. He resigned as the head of Strong Financial Corporation last December. The settlement comes after months of investigation by state and federal authorities. It's part of an ongoing investigation into the mutual fund industry. Two other executives were also permanently barred from the securities industry, and Strong Capital Management will pay $80 million in penalties and fee reductions. The company is up for sale. For NPR News, I'm Anna Panoka in Milwaukee.
Federal authorities have released a Portland, Oregon attorney who was arrested in connection with the Madrid train bombings. Brandon Mayfield was arrested after U.S. authorities said his fingerprints were found on a bag containing bomb components that were found near the bombing sites. Spanish officials now say the fingerprints in question were those of an Algerian man. Mayfield was arrested on a material witness statute, which enables officials to hold a person without filing charges. Mayfield is a Muslim convert who once represented Jeffrey Battle, one of six men who recently pleaded guilty to planning to help the Taliban fight American forces in Afghanistan. Mayfield only represented Battle in a child custody case. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Over 40 million Arabic people around the world tune into the Arabic news network Al Jazeera, which went on the air in 1996, through its satellite broadcast from Qatar. Al Jazeera has been able to circumvent Arab governments that censor the news. The network's critics say that its news is biased against America and Israel. The documentary, The Control Room, takes us behind the scenes of Al Jazeera just before and during the war in Iraq. It was shot at Al Jazeera's headquarters in Qatar and 10 miles away at CENTCOM, the U.S. military central command, where reporters from around the world had gathered for briefings from the American military. The movie introduces us to some of the journalists at Al Jazeera and shows their interactions with U.S. military press officer Lieutenant Josh Rushing. Rushing has since been promoted to captain. In this scene, Lieutenant Rushing is speaking with Hassan Ibrahim, a reporter from Al Jazeera. The lieutenant had just said that the Americans believe that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction and that they had the will to use them against us. Okay. Ibrahim responds.
When did Saddam threaten the U.S. with weapons of mass destruction?
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question. We believe he had the will to give them the forces to use against us and... Well, go ahead.
I'm just conveying to you what people are saying. They're saying that the U.S. is inventing a purpose as it goes along. In the beginning, it was weapons of mass destruction, and then the whole thing transformed into removing Saddam from power. So...
Why do they think we're doing it? What do they think our motives are?
No one knows. I mean, people think you're
really?
There. People think you're there to basically control the oil of Iraq, control the Iraqi foreign politics, to control the region.
I won't back down off of my point when we talk about our intent in this, in what we're doing. We're not here to occupy an Arab land. We're not here to take their oil. We're not here to kill Arabs or take mosque or any of the other myriad of reasons.
A scene from the documentary The Control Room. Throughout the film, Ibrahim and Lieutenant Rushing continue their conversation and their attempts to understand each other's point of view. My guests are Jahan Nujaim, the director of the film, and Samir Kadir, a senior producer at Al Jazeera. He's prominently featured in the film. Yesterday, I asked Nujaim why she wanted to make the movie.
I've grown up between the Middle East and the United States my entire life. My mother is American and my father's Egyptian. And going back and forth, you see very different perceptions of what's happening in the world. And that leads you to think about where are people getting their perspectives from and leads you to the news and news creation. And I used to volunteer at a very small village on the outskirts of Cairo, which was a very poor neighborhood. I used to teach classes there. And I remember going back soon after Jazeera started, and people were pooling their money together to buy satellite dishes because they were able to watch these debate shows that had addressed topics that were previously taboo. And so it was fascinating to watch people watching these programs about the role of religion in the government and, you know, and the issue of the veil and many, many issues that had never been talked about before. And they had become very, very widely criticized by different Arab governments, including the Egyptian government. And then more recently, they were heavily criticized by the United States and the U.S. administration. So I was just thinking, you know, this channel that's so popular with the people and yet so hated and just criticized by all of these governments, you know, has to be doing something right. And who are these people behind it?
What was your approach when you went to CENTCOM during the war in Iraq to cover how Al Jazeera was covering the war, and to also, you know, speak at length with a U.S. Military press officer, and speak as well to other members of the American media? What was your strategy in comparing and contrasting?
You know, I don't think I had much of a strategy, and I didn't really seek out to compare and contrast. What I wanted to find were people that were really going through a struggle to try and figure out, you know, how to report the news as fairly as possible, how to get the information. And when I went to CENTCOM, I spoke to a number of Western journalists. I spoke to people from ABC, CNN, NBC, but it was very difficult to get access at the time because there was a kind of a culture of fear because Peter Arnett had just been fired for talking to Iraqi television. And people were basically like, look, I have a lot to say on this, but I'm not willing to lose my job for this, you know, this documentary that you're doing. And everybody had signed contracts with their companies that said that they weren't going to give their personal opinions on camera, that they weren't allowed to give their personal opinions. So we got very, very lucky in finding Tom Mintier from CNN. He was a seasoned journalist. He'd started with CNN. He'd been through the Vietnam War, the last Gulf War. And so when we met him and we talked to him about the project that we were doing, that we were just following journalists from Al Jazeera and from Central Command, he said, sure, I'll be a part of it. I don't know if he ever asked for permission. He's actually not with CNN anymore. But he was somebody that I think felt like he had the leeway to go ahead and give his views. But he was very careful about what he was saying. And then meeting Lieutenant Rushing was really completely by chance. I met him through through our executive producer who was there as a journalist.
Rushing is the military press officer who
right
interacts with all the press at CENTCOM.
Right, right. He interacts with all the press, but his assignment was to explain the American position in Iraq primarily to the Arab journalists that were at CENTCOM, to mm-hmm. Al Jazeera, to Abu Dhabi Television, and to Al Arabiya. So I thought that he was going to be faced with some very interesting questions because he was somebody that, to me, seemed like he had a lot of integrity. He said very early on, look, I wouldn't be able to do this job if I didn't honestly believe that we're here for the right purposes. And, you know, maybe we won't decrease terrorism in, you know, a week, a month, but give it 10 years. We're looking at generations. We're looking long term here. And he was somebody that I found to be very, very dedicated and very good at what he did.
Now, Joshua Rushing, the U.S. military press officer, who part of your film is built around, he's one of the main characters, so to speak, in the movie. He was originally going to join us today in our interview, but then we found out he couldn't come. What was the reason for that?
Well, I'm not sure exactly where it is right now. Right before I came into this interview, I was making phone calls to see whether he could be a part of some of the interviews in the future. You know, I think this is really, it's really too bad because he's somebody that definitely opened my eyes and made me see that the military is a very diverse operation and you have people that are really trying to understand the other side, understand the point of view and interact with the other side. So we had dinner with him yesterday and he's in his hotel today and he's still waiting to get permission. But, hopefully it'll come through. It's actually a different section of the military that he got the permission from CENTCOM. It was his assignment to be dealing with this documentary as well as Al Jazeera. So hopefully he'll be able to talk about his views in the future.
My guest is Jahan Najam, and she directed the new documentary, The Control Room, which is about press coverage of the war in Iraq, comparing the perspectives of the U.S. military press officer of Al Jazeera and the American media. I want to introduce Samir Kadir, who is a senior producer with Al Jazeera, and he's one of the people interviewed in the control room. Samir, welcome. And let me ask you just a really big, broad, general question, and that is, how would you compare how Al Jazeera covered the war with how American TV covered it? And I should preface that by saying I know that American TV is made up of a lot of different stations who covered it differently, but I know I'm dealing with generalizations here. So that said,
it's our job to follow what other news organizations are doing, because you have to compare yourself with somebody else, so as to try to assess yourself. I think that both of us, whether on Al Jazeera and the United States and Europe, every professional news organization covered the war the same way, with the same professional criteria, with the same dedication, with the same objectivity, and here's the difference, with a different perspective. For example, what's important for the American audience doesn't mean that this thing is important for an Arab audience. While the American organizations will focus on the American troops in the field, an Arab news organization will focus on the people of Iraq, the people who are suffering. This is the only difference. So we have different perspectives, but the same coverage, the same criteria.
One of the specific comments about your war coverage that Joshua Rushing makes, and he is the U.S. Military press officer who's interviewed a lot in the movie The Control Room. He says that, you know, like right before you went to commercial breaks, there was a collage that would show, you know, American troops coming in and tanks and bombs, and then there'd be an image of a young child who was wounded with her head bandaged, as if the point of this collage was just to make a point that the Americans are there and they're causing suffering.
You have collage in all news channels. You have it on CNN, you have it on NBC, on ABC. Every news channel have their own collage. But if you look to the same collage on CNN or any American news channel, you will see something. And this something appeals to your audience. My audience, our audience in Al Jazeera, are the people of Iraq and the people of the Middle East. The people of the Middle East consider Iraq as their brothers, as Arabs and Muslims. So they focus on the suffering of the war. We didn't say that this war was just or unjust. We were just saying that this war brings suffering to the people. Is it the right instrument to be used to topple a dictatorship? That's all what we said.
I'm interested in how you're covering what's going on in Iraq now. Let's start with the prison abuse scandal. You know, Americans have been seeing the photographs of the naked Iraqi prisoners tied together with American soldiers giving the thumbs up sign. We saw the photograph of a naked Iraqi who was being threatened with attack dogs and who was later bit by one of those attack dogs, although that photo has not been released. Have you been showing those photos?
Yes, we have shown the photos that were shown by all news American organizations, no more, no less. We covered it exactly the same manner that was covered by the American news channels, with some focus, of course, on the fact that these kinds of practices used to be the rule when Saddam Hussein was in power, and they are still now considered as a general rule in many Arab countries. So the general feeling of our audience was the following. These practices are very common in this part of the world, but it's not common in the United States. And the United States, America, came to the region with the flag of freedom and liberation and democracy. So it was very odd for Arabs to see these kinds of practices. So their reaction was, if America does the same thing as our regimes, what's the difference?
Are you covering the American reaction to those photos and to what went on at Abu Ghraib? The fact that there are hearings, that there's a lot of outrage, that that it was the American press that uncovered this, that even people in the CIA have leaked the information because they thought it was so wrong.
Yes, we cover these reactions in full. And you may be surprised to know that all the hearings, the congressional hearings, were broadcast live on Al Jazeera for 3-4 consecutive hours every day.
Did you get a big audience for that?
Yes. People love to follow these things because they see democracy in action. They see accountability and responsibility.
My guests are Jahan Nujaim, the director of the documentary The Control Room, and Samira Kadir, a senior producer at Al Jazeera. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Jahan Nujaim, director of the documentary The Control Room, which takes us behind the scenes at the Arabic news network Al Jazeera, and Samir Kadir, a senior producer at Al Jazeera. I just want to ask you about something that I know has been very controversial in the United States, and that is the use of the word martyrs to describe suicide bombers. And I know that Al Jazeera uses the word martyrs to describe Palestinians who blow themselves up to attack Israelis. Have you been using the word martyrs for Iraqis also?
No. But you know, it's a theological debate here. I can't really answer you about that. But bear in mind that the word suicide attack in the Arabic language, suicide means infidelity, means that you don't believe in God. So we don't use the word suicide. So we are bound to use the word martyr. And the word martyr in Arabic, it doesn't have the same meaning like martyr in English or any other Latin languages. So you have, for example, somebody crossing the street and hit by a car, he's a martyr. This is the full meaning of the word in Arabic.
I don't understand. What does it mean?
Martyr means that... a person who's martyred is a person that God has chosen to call him to him, let's say.
But this is different than getting hit by a car, because it's not an act of chance or accident. It's something that somebody planned intentionally to kill other people.
I know. I'm not talking about hit and run, no. I'm talking about pure accident.
Right, but I mean, something that's a pure accident is kind of qualitatively different than somebody deciding to end their life solely for the purpose of killing other people.
No, I'm sorry. This is a debate that transcends my capacity, my intellectual capacity.
Is this a debate that you have at Al Jazeera, or does everybody at Al Jazeera agree about it?
Yes, we talk about that every day in our editorial meetings.
As an editor at Al Jazeera, what's your position on that? What do you argue when the debates begin?
I try always to push the direction of secularism and journalism, which means to leave all the spiritual and theological consideration behind us. But I'm only one, and I have others who support my position, but since we are a channel preaching democracy, we should at least be a democratic channel.
Are you saying that you lose on that one, but you defer to the majority?
No. Look, we don't vote on these things. There's no vote. There is a consensus.
Right. But are you saying you disagree with the use of the word martyr because it's too theological?
Yes, too much theological is.
What are some of the reactions you've gotten from Arab governments to stories that you've run? Some of the Arab governments are famous for press censorship. One of the important roles that Al Jazeera has played is as satellite television operating from Qatar. You don't have to pass your stories through the kind of government censorship that you'd have to operate from you'd have to deal with if you were based in certain other Arab countries. So have there been attempts by Arab governments to try to pressure you into not covering certain stories, or have
yes,
there just been
course.
Yeah? Tell us a little bit about that. Wait,
there's nothing to tell. It's something obvious. Any government in the Arab world, when we try to tackle a given file, a given subject, they try to cover up the story and they try to prevent us from covering it. And we had all the wrath of the religious establishment, the Islamic world, not only the Arab world. And we tackled also items regarding corruption in the highest sphere of Arab governments. And, you know, these questions are very, very sensitive in our area. When you tell your public that this or minister or this prime minister or this president is a corrupt one and you bring the evidence of this corruption, of course, these countries will not be easy in dealing with us.
You say in the control room that you would take a Fox, you would take a job at Fox TV if they offered you, if they offered you one. I think that's probably not about to happen.
It has nothing to do with it. It happens or not. It was a little taken out of context. The questions that was directed to me by Jihan, it was if I would consider to move to America to take a job in the United States, and I said why not, and. From previous conversations, she used to know that I don't really appreciate what Fox News do regarding the war in Iraq. And her answer was, even with Fox? I said, why not? Even with Fox, yeah.
Now, in the movie The Control Room, you say that you hope to send your children to America to study. I think you also say you hope that they'll live in America. Do you have dual feelings about America?
I love America. I respect the American way and American ideals. Everything about America. But like any Arab, Middle Eastern human being, I hate American policies, the American foreign policy regarding the Middle East, especially regarding the Palestinian question.
So you make a distinction between American foreign policy and American values in America itself.
Yes, of course. And this is what we always try to explain on the screens of Al Jazeera to our audience, that there is a difference between the American people and the American government.
Well, thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Samira Kadir is a senior producer at Al Jazeera. Jahan Nujaim directed the new documentary, The Control Room. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams, available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. And from the Atlantic Monthly, featuring Jeffrey Wheatcroft on Tony Blair's March to War and Fall from Favor, on newsstands and at theatlantic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Fresh Air linguist Jeff Nunberg. He has a new book called Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new 25th anniversary edition DVD of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has a new book that collects his broadcast commentaries and the columns he's written for the New York Times. Jeff is a senior researcher at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University and chair of the Usage Panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. He says that his new book isn't really for language buffs. It's not about the way the language is going to hell in a handbasket. The book is about what language can tell us about our culture and our changing ideas and sensibilities. It's called Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. And yes, I'm not accidentally mispronouncing the title. The title is Going Nuclear. I'll let Jeff explain why.
That's the title of one of the pieces in the book about George Bush's pronunciation of nuclear as nuclear. And it struck me as standing in for a lot of the ways people think about the language and the way Bush uses it in particular. I had listened to it. Everybody thinks it's just a kind of mistake born of ignorance. But the more I thought about it, the more it struck me that in Bush's mouth, it was probably less merely a mistake and more a kind of choice. I call it a faux Bubba pronunciation.
I'm wondering if you think you can hear the so-called culture wars reflected in the way America is speaking. If you hear divisions and how people on different sides of the political spectrum speak.
Well, there are different kinds of divisions. I mean, obviously, there are going to be divisions in the way people talk about the particular issues that have been in the fore in the culture wars. So whether you describe a certain position as being pro-life or anti-abortion rights or pro-choice or anti-life, I guess, depends obviously what position you take on that issue. But in another sense, I think it goes even deeper than that. I think there are differences in tone between the left and the right that run a lot deeper than that. You know, I was listening a couple of years ago to a right-wing, kind of an angry white guy radio station, because I can be an angry white guy at times, too. And I noticed that the host of those stations are always using see, the Democrats really don't want to tell you that such and such, or see, those people really don't want to work. We're on left-wing radio stations like Pacifica or on NPR. People don't say see, they say look. And that's an important difference, that look is the word you use when you're trying to persuade somebody of something. See's the word you use when you're trying to clue somebody in on something. It struck me that it really was suggestive of two very different mentalities that are associated with those two sides.
Were you saying that NPR is left-wing?
No, I said.
Or, you use the word
left-wing
or.
Stations, okay. or NPR.
Okay, just checking. Have you been listening to the language of the presidential campaign and how President Bush and John Kerry have been speaking?
Yeah, I don't think it's really gotten going yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it'll emerge in a couple of months, but there are already some clear differences. I mean, one thing that was very striking during the Democratic primaries was that for the first time in many years, the Democrats were not reluctant to talk about words, use words like moral and values and so on. Kerry was saying that the U.S. has a broken value system. Howard Dean was saying we've lost our moral compass. John Edwards was using that kind of language. And that, I think, reflects an interesting shift, even as the Republicans have either taken over or tried to neutralize a lot of the language of the left. The Democrats have moved in and are trying to neutralize or reassert their ownership of a lot of that language of values and families and so on.
Jeff, I'm just kind of curious. We often get feedback to the pieces you've done on Fresh Air, but I'm wondering, you get feedback directly, too. Of the pieces that you've done for us, what's been the most controversial? What's gotten the biggest response?
Well, the one piece that's gotten by far the biggest response was a piece I did back in, I think, 2001 on Bernard Goldberg's book, Bias, which claimed that a sign that the media had a liberal bias was the fact that they always identify conservatives as conservatives, but they never identify liberals as liberals. And he just kind of asserted this without any evidence. So I thought, well, this is something we can check. We can do counts nowadays. So I went to a bunch of major newspapers and set up this rather elaborate procedure for doing the counts. And I discovered, well, no, as it happens, major newspapers identify liberals as liberals about 35% more often than they identify conservatives as conservatives. I got enormous amounts of mail on that piece, and it was picked up by CNN and other stations and became a controversial matter, and other people did other counts and so on. So I'd have to say that because it got into that particular controversy about bias, it was the piece that received the most mail by far.
Now, I think it's so interesting that there are these computerized search engines that you can use now to research things like this that you would have never been able to research before, at least not as quickly and easily.
No, you know, it's completely changed the way people think about lexicography and language. The Oxford English Dictionary, when it appeared, contained a total of, I think, about 1,800,000 citations for all the words to demonstrate the meanings of the words that were collected over a period of 30 or 35 years by all of these volunteer readers who sat there writing out little slips, which were then sent into Oxford and assembled in the little shed in the back of Sir James Murray's garden. And nowadays, I can do a Google search or a Nexus search and find 1,000,000 citations for a single word, like insane, in the course of a couple of seconds. So that's one way that they can be interesting. Another thing we can do is we can count things, which you couldn't do before. You can look to see if a word's becoming more popular or less popular. I did a piece for Fresh Air on the word royal. Phyllis Myers, the producer, called me and said, well, what's with this word royal? How come I keep seeing it? R-O-I-L, I mean. And I said, gee, I don't know. And I went to the newspaper databases, and I looked. And sure enough, that word had become 10 times as common in newspapers as it was 20 years ago. Now, it's a favorite word of headline writers because it's only 4 letters long and, you know, 2 of them are skinny. But it's just a word that suddenly became more frequent for some reason. Sometimes that's more interesting, the word... I went and looked to see how people have described Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth over the decades. And it turns out that they're about 3 times as likely now to be described as legends as opposed to heroes as they were 20 years ago. And that's a sign of how this word legend is taking the place of hero in the lexicon. You can look at a phrase like class warfare, for example, and watch it spike whenever the Democrats start to criticize Republican tax proposals. So in those ways, you can really discover enormous numbers of things about the ways words are used.
So with the help of search engines, are you doing a different kind of linguistic analysis than you used to? Are you looking for things that you didn't look for before?
Oh, yeah. I'm always trying to figure out ways now to make a point statistically, just in terms of some little almost statistical anecdote that drives home a point that otherwise wouldn't be clear. Not long ago, I went to the New York Times and the Washington Post. And I did a search on the phrases liberal values and conservative values. And it turned out that even in those supposedly liberal papers, conservative values was something like 3 or 4 times as frequent as liberal values was, which is really a sign of how we think of that word values, that we just it belongs to the right and doesn't belong to the left. And that's a point it would be hard to make if you didn't have that little statistical anecdote to go on.
My guest is linguist Jeff Nunberg. He has a new book collecting his Fresh Air commentaries and New York Times columns. It's called Going Nuclear. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air's language commentator, Jeff Nunberg, and he has a new book called Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. And it collects pieces that he's written over the past few years for Fresh Air, the New York Times, and other places. We've been talking about language that has some kind of political charge to it. You've done a lot of pieces that have absolutely nothing to do with that. One of the most popular pieces that you did for Fresh Air was on the use of the word like. And how that has changed. And like is a word that so many people find irritating. And you had such interesting things to say about it. I'm going to ask you to just, like, recap a couple of ways that you think the word like has changed from the way it was first used by hipsters in the 50s.
I think we owe the hipsters either the responsibility or the blame for a lot of the words that have been most important over the last 50 years. Like cool is a word that came out of the hipsters. And so is like in an interesting way. I mean, it was used by the hipsters as a way of distancing themselves from what they were saying. And it was picked up by a bunch of disc jockeys like Wolfman Jack and High Lit, the Philadelphia disc jockey. It passed into teenage slang with the help of that Bob Denver character, the Maynard G. Krebs beatnik character in The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. And it entered teenage slang sometime in the 60s, at which point it instantly became, for most observers, an index of the general degeneration of the teenage mind and attention and of everything that was wrong in America, as if they themselves had spoken perfect grammatical English when they were in their teens. But it did a lot of work in teenage language at that time. It was a way of distancing yourself from a request, for example. You'd say, could I, like, borrow your sweater? Which was a little more polite in some way than saying, could I borrow your sweater? And then sometime around the 80s, it became what we linguists call a quotative, as in, so I was like, you've got to be kidding. Moon Unit Zappa helped that one along a lot, and it became associated with Valley Girl slang, spread very rapidly, and once again was denounced as the most terrible thing that had happened to the English language since the Norman invasion. It's interesting because when you listen to the way teenagers use that, either in its kind of weakening sense or in this quotative sense, it has a real purpose. What struck me about this was that I was thinking about the word, and I was listening to the news reports of a school shooting down near San Diego a couple of years ago. They were interviewing all these students about what had happened. The students were clearly shaken up and disturbed by it. They weren't particularly articulate. They were saying, you know, and so on and so forth. They didn't say like. None of those teenagers said like in describing what had happened. And that's because like is a word that conveys a certain ironic distance from what you're talking about. And when the circumstances don't call for ironic distance, they just turn it off. It isn't just a mindless tick, in other words. It has a meaning. It's used when it's appropriate. It isn't used when it isn't appropriate.
In your new book, Going Nuclear, you have collected pieces from Fresh Air, the New York Times, and other places you've written for, and you also write a little bit about the fact that you've written for blogs. And, you know, you mentioned that the style for each of these is different. And I'd be really interested in hearing about the difference in how you write, say, for a newspaper and how you write for our show. Now, I know Phyllis, who produces your commentaries for Fresh Air, is probably always trying to encourage you to write in short, straightforward sentences because the ear finds it easier to follow sentences that are like that, where there's no grammatical complications, there's no, like, inversions, there's not a lot of separate clauses. But, of course, in a newspaper, you don't have to worry about that kind of thing. So can you talk a little bit about what it's been like for you to write for both mediums?
Well, writing certainly for Fresh Air and for radio in general, there are all these little grammatical tricks that you're talking about. You write these very short declarative sentences. You avoid using relative clauses. You don't ever make lists of more than three items. That's a rule that Phyllis told me early on when I started doing these, and I found is a very good rule to bear in mind. And the other things, I mean, the fact is that when you're doing a radio piece, as you know, you're coming to the end of the piece and you want your listeners to know that the piece is about to end, so you have to have this kind of summary, little quippy sentence at the end to say, okay, now the piece is about to end, now we're coming to the end, now here's a little quip to tell you that the piece is over, because you don't have a little box at the end of the article in the page. So there are a lot of differences like that. Of course, writing for the New York Times has its own quirks and whatever. I mean, everybody's Mr., you know, Mr. Sting, Ms. Cher, and so on. You have to give these full identifications of everybody, and you have to write in this slight. I have a lot of trouble writing for the Times in a lively way. I think it's like the font, right? Anything that shows up in that font is gonna sound like that.
You dedicate your book, Going Nuclear, to your father, who you describe as a lover of words. In what sense was he that?
Well, he was someone who took language very seriously, who was scrupulous, even fastidious, about getting the rules right. I recall once somebody used the word fulsome in a way that just meant copious or abundant. He said, no, fulsome means treacly or sickening or excessive. In that sense, it doesn't mean that, and held his finger up in the air. That was really very characteristic of second-generation immigrants, particularly Jewish immigrants of his generation, who felt that in some way mastering the language was a way of creating a kind of entitlement to American culture. One of the things that's very striking is how many of the language mavens, and note that word mavens, are in fact Jews of that generation, Theodore Bernstein and John Simon and Edwin Newman and William Sapphire and so forth, all of whom inherited in some sense that affection and fastidiousness about English usage.
How do you see your work compared to theirs?
Well, in a certain sense, I inherited that from my dad, too. I took it to excess or whatever when I became a linguist. And at that point, you begin to think of language not just in terms of a set of little rules of correctness and so on, but as this deeper, more complex structure that really a lifetime of study will not get you to the heart of. And at that point, you begin to think of language differently. You begin to think not just of trying to get the rules right and so on, but understand why the rules are the rules and what the language is trying to tell us. And at some point, listening to language becomes a way of finding out other things. You know, the words that most people find interesting when they hear you're a linguist, they say, oh, I'm interested in that. And the words like serendipitous or antimacassar or things like that, where what makes linguists linguists are linguists are the ones who think that a really interesting word is like the. And so linguistics is into the battle for the long haul. But I'm not actually that interested in words as such. If you find yourself thinking about a word and it doesn't take you somewhere outside of language, then it's usually not that interesting. Where what's interesting is the way words can betray attitudes, social changes, ways of thinking about the world that would otherwise be really hard to get at.
In your role as a father, have you ever been in conflict with your role as a linguist? In other words, hearing your daughter talk as she grows up, is there a conflict in you between wanting to correct her as a father to make sure she speaks well and properly and all that, and an interest in just standing back and listening? Because that's what you do as in your role as a linguist. You listen and observe and then try to figure out what it means.
Yeah, for a long time I said, I'm not going to correct my daughter. She'll come to the right forms, in due time. And I'm really more interested in listening to what she has to say and trying to understand it. Because I think to a certain extent, if you're always trying to correct, you're not really going to be listening to what's going on. And I had this very strong belief till, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago when she started to have writing assignments. I would have to go over them with her. And at that point, all bets were off. No, Sophie, you put a comma before a non-restrictive clause and so on. And at that point, I began to correct her. But I still don't correct her, I think, in the way my father would have corrected me.
Which was?
She might dispute that. But
how would he correct
well,
you?
Well, my sense is that what do I know? This is the correct rule. Sooner or later, she'll learn it. If she doesn't learn it, maybe it wasn't that important a rule to begin with. So I kind of let it go. I certainly don't, when she, these old bugbears, when she says hopefully or she uses anxious to mean eager and things like that. I mean, everybody does that. And who cares? I certainly don't correct her when she uses like, as in, so I was like, you got to be kidding and so on. Because that's just part of the language she speaks. It would be absurd for me to correct that.
Well, Jeff, a pleasure to talk with you.
Great to talk to you, Terry.
And take care.
Thank you. And thank you for having me on.
And congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Jeff Nunberg's new book is called Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Coming up, Lord Schwartz reviews a new 25th anniversary edition DVD of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd. This is Fresh Air. A Broadway revival of Stephen Sondheim's Assassins has been nominated for 7 Tony Awards. If you can't get to the theater, you can stay home and watch a great Stephen Sondheim musical. To celebrate the 25th anniversary of Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, Warner Home Video has released a DVD of the version that was shown on TV in 1982 with some members of the original cast, including Angela Lansbury. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says the new restored DVD is a major addition to the Sondheim discography, one of the most successful transfers of a Broadway show to the small screen.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd.
The tale of Sweeney Todd.
He served a dark and avengeful god. What happened then? Well, that's the play, and he wouldn't want us to give it away. Not Sweeney, not Sweeney Todd, the demon of Barbara Fleet Street.
Stephen Sondheim's most ambitious, some would say most operatic, and grimmest musical opened on Broadway 25 years ago and walked away with 8 Tony Awards. 3 years later, it was taped for television in Los Angeles, and the multiple cameras captured both the fluidity and the tension of director Harold Prince's legendary production. George Hearn, who replaced Len Cariou as the revenge-obsessed Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street, won an Emmy for this TV version, and Angela Lansbury, one of those original Tony winners, repeats the role she created, Mrs. Lovett, the maker of the worst pies in London.
What your rush, what your hurry? You gave me such a fright, I thought you was a ghost. Half a minute, can't you sit, sit you down, sit? All I meant is that I haven't seen a customer for weeks. Did you come in for a pie, sir? Do forgive me if me head's a little vague. What is that? But you think we had the plague? From the way the people keep avoiding, now you don't. Heaven as I try, sir. But there's no one comes in even to inhale. Right you are, sir, would you like a drop of ale? Mind you, I can't hardly blame them. These are probably the worst pies in London.
The story first saw the light of day as a hoary melodrama about the victim of a sinister plot who is determined to give his villainous enemies closer shaves than they ever bargained for. Then his lady friend grinds their remains into tasty meat pies. Sondheim and Harold Prince turn this raw material into an existential indictment of human greed and cruelty.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it, and its morals aren't worth what a pig could spit, and it goes by the name of London. At the top of the hole sit the privileged few, making mock of the vermin in the lower zoo, turning beauty into filth and greed. I, too, have sailed the world and seen its wonders. For the cruelty of men is as wondrous as Peru. But there's no place like London.
This is a long way from Oh, What a Beautiful Morning. But Sondheim's score is one of his richest, and the performances are hair-raising. It's a powerful work, though I have to confess I like it best when it's got its tongue in its cheek, along with those savory meat pies.
What is that?
It's priest. Have a little priest.
Is it really good?
Sir, it's too good, at least. Then again, they don't commit sins of the flesh. So it's pretty fresh.
Awful lot of fat.
Only where it's sat.
Haven't you got poet or something like that?
No, you see, the trouble with poet is, how do you know it's deceased? Try the priest.
Heavenly! Well, not.
Along with Sweeney Todd, Warner Home Video has also released an enjoyable example of non-musical Sondheim, a fiendishly clever 1973 film called The Last of Sheila, which Sondheim co-wrote with fellow mystery buff, Psycho star Anthony Perkins. Here we have more murder and revenge, but in a slyer vein, a campy whodunit, glamorously filmed on the Riviera and full of Hollywood inside jokes. The plotting is as deliriously intricate as one of Sondheim's cascades of multiple rhymes. Even the three gossipy stars on the DVD's alternate soundtrack, Richard Benjamin, Diane Cannon, and Raquel Welch, admit they can't quite follow the plot.
I have to say I had a very hard time understanding exactly what the game was all about. I was always getting lost and couldn't figure out what was going on. I mean, I could and then I couldn't, you know, because it was very complicated.
Other members of the lively cast include James Mason as a director who may be a little too fond of little girls, and devilish James Coburn as both the precipitator of the plot and one of its victims. Was he, like Sweeney Todd, out for justifiable revenge, or was he just your typical Hollywood sadist? Even the title holds a clue. You might have to watch The Last of Sheila more than once to find out, if you ever do.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. I'm Terry Gross.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd.
He served a dark and a hungry god.
He served a dark and a hungry god.
To seek revenge may lead to hell.
But everyone does it, and seldom as well
as Sweeney.
As Sweeney Todd. But in a lover of feet, street,
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the great jazz drummer Elvin Jones. He died Tuesday at the age of 76. He was best known for his work with John Coltrane. Join us for the next Fresh Air.